Our speaker tonight is a dear personal friend of mine and someone who sponsors me when my sponsor is unavailable, sometimes even during those periods when my sponsor is available, he sponsors me. He has been instrumental in my recovery and has been a blessing in my life, and with that I give you Dave.
Thanks, Tim. I'm Dave Schultz, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is June the 18th, 1993. 10 years ago, this would have been a dream come true for me to have a room full of people to hold captive for an hour so I could talk about myself. Fortunately, in the past 9+ years, I've had a few awakenings along the way. So tonight I'm going to talk to you about the way it was and what happened to me, and the way it is now. I grew up in Texas, in a small community, mostly ranching. And I grew up living in a trailer next to my grandmother's beer joint on a farm-to-market road, and come from a long line of alcoholics and horse thieves. My grandmother, through all of my childhood, until her death, was active in her addiction and was a very violent woman who had to fend for herself and live on her own, by her own wits, her own strength and courage, in some pretty rough times. She raised her family of 7 children, one of which was my mother, who inherited everything that her mother had to offer. I am an only child. Yeah. And guess who inherited everything my mother had to offer? The older I get, the more I realize that I'm just like my mother, which has been an amazing discovery along this path. I started out as an early child living in a household of dual addiction and violence. And as a result, I was very quickly able to adapt my behaviors to survival techniques, learning how to hold my breath and blend into a wall so you don't get hit with something like a beer bottle, learning how to hide, learning how to be the perfect child to all outside appearances. I learned how not to show emotion and not to show fear. Unfortunately, that model didn't serve me well as I got older, but the behaviors didn't change. Once I had that routine down pat, I stuck with it for a long, long time. Because everyone in my family used and abused substances, I was determined that my life was going to be different. And of course, when I got old enough to get myself out of Texas, I did. And I ran as fast and far as I could. And I continued running for the next 30 years. From every situation that I ever faced that required any adult mature behavior. As a result of that, in the Army, I hadn't even had a drink until I was in the Army. I did have, I think I was probably the only high school kid in my hometown that was on Milltown, which at that time was a pretty strong tranquilizer way back in the dark ages. And I used other drugs on occasion when the opportunity arose, but I was determined that alcohol was not going to pass my lips. I had seen what the damage of alcohol addiction did to my family of origin. In the Army, all that changed. Everybody drank. I drank with them. From the very first time I drank alcohol, I drank alcoholically. I drank to the point that I threw up. I was a puker. I would drink until I puked all the time, and yet I continued to drink. I never drank moderately. I always drank to the point till I puked. That was when you quit drinking. I had the opportunity to prove that you can't teach an old dog new tricks for a long, 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 long time, because I never connected the puking with the behavior. I blamed the alcohol for the puking. So of course I tried different kinds of alcohol, different combinations, different places, eating, not eating, all those sorts of things to see if I could figure out how to beat this system. But my body was never equipped to handle alcohol, particularly in the volume in which I sucked it down. I still drink addictively like an alcoholic. I drank more iced tea than any person in their right mind would drink. In fact, I have to pee now. I cannot keep Coca-Cola in my house because if it's in the fridge, I'm going to drink it. Some habits die hard. By the time I got out of the service, I felt like I was all grown up and taking care of myself and half the other known world, and was perfectly competent to do so. I proceeded on my merry way and got married to a lovely woman, and taught her how to drink. She came from one of those weird little families where they did not indulge, and I thought we had to get that squared away right off the bat. So I taught her how to drink. She did not like bourbon, however, so we were destined for a divorce. She liked scotch, which I barely tolerated, but would drink when I couldn't get anything else. But we drank for a few years socially. I was always a social drinker. I was very social in that time. All through my 20s, I was so social I can barely remember them. We eventually had a family. I have one son. And I call him Dr. Baby at this point. He is probably the greatest joy in my life, that child. And his mother and I both have put his welfare above all else. That was not always easy to do. But I think we were fairly successful in doing that. That's probably the only place that I have any pride in my life, is the things that I have done for that child. And I'm grateful that somehow God was with me to work that out. Of course, the God issue was a whole new ball of wax for me. When I came to the program, I thought I was so smart. I had all the answers. I knew everything. I could tell you exactly who God was, how God worked, why God did it, why he wasn't working for you, why he only worked for me, why I could solve all your problems if you just did what I told you. I had all these great things going for me, and I was miserable, and I was dying. I continued to drink and occasionally use other substances and certainly used other behaviors addictively and to my detriment for many, many years. As I said earlier, my marriage ended in divorce. It didn't come as a surprise to anybody but me. I was the last person to get the word and was the most shocked to hear it. And of course, because of that, I drank and drugged and partied for 2 years solid. It was a crazy time in my life. I continued that behavior even though I held a very responsible position professionally. I turned into a binge drinker. And because I worked in the judicial system, I would have to be sober and present for periods of time, and then I could disappear for periods of time. And so I used all those off times to binge. And I like to say that I like to travel, and so I would travel. That just meant that I could get drunk and ride in taxis and not have to worry about driving or getting myself from one place to another, and I could drink in a place where they didn't know me. Other towns, other states, other countries, finally, but the pattern was the same. My world got smaller and smaller and smaller. My disease was truly a disease of isolation, and I began shutting people out of my life in my 30s. It became too onerous to explain to them why I wouldn't show up when I had promised faithfully to be there, why when I did show up I was shit-faced and could care less about what they were doing and was disruptive to the process. The burden got to be too great to face my friends who were saying to me, "What was wrong with you? Why'd you do that? Why'd you say that?" So I just started shutting those people out of my life. I hid away for a few years and continued to drink and be destructive. Finally, I was in Europe on a small vacation and woke up one morning traveling with a friend on a bar tour of Germany and was reeking alcohol. My saliva tasted like it was 100 proof. I was in really bad shape. And I remember starting the day off with a small glass of Remy Martin cognac before I could brush my teeth. That was the last thing I remembered until I woke up in the hospital in Decatur. And that was on June the 18th of 1993. So I'm not exactly sure when my last drink was, but I can remember the first day I had to face the fact that I couldn't have another one. I'm sure that in that hazy period that I had physicians who said to me the word alcoholic. I didn't hear it, didn't want to hear it. They told me I couldn't drink. I said, "Fine, I don't care. I'm a social drinker, it doesn't matter to me." And so I left the hospital and I didn't drink. I did lots of other things obsessively and compulsively and to my detriment, and ended up a few years after that in a complete physical breakdown. I lost my career. I was confined for a year of bed rest. I had lost my business. Still had my house, fortunately. Had gone through a lot of excuses, a lot of emotional entanglements, relationships, used a lot of people, used them badly, used them shamelessly. For which I always expected just such a payback. But eventually what happened for me, I pissed off a lot of people. But eventually what happened for me was I had a friend who literally picked me up off the floor of the bathroom in my house and said to me, would I like to go to a meeting with her? I thought she was truly out of her mind, because all I wanted to do was just lie on the floor and beg the God I didn't believe in and blame for everything that was wrong in my life to just let me die. But I laid there for quite a while and got no results. So I decided to get up, and eventually I went to a meeting with her. I didn't belong in AA. Clearly, you people were crazy. And so far beneath me that I couldn't even think about spending time with you. And certainly I didn't have anything in common with you. So I went to Al-Anon, since all my relationships had been with drunks. I thought probably the problem was the people I was associating with. So I went to Al-Anon, and then I graduated into ACOA, and I whined with the best of them for a year or two. And then I thought, my biggest problem was relationships, so then I jumped over to CODA. None of that was helping, and I was just really miserable. So 5 years after my last drink, I had an emotional breakdown and decided I would kill myself, because living had become intolerable. I hated my life. I hated everyone in it, and I didn't have the strength or the energy to play anymore. When I finally reached that point, my friend came back and said, "Would you like to go to a meeting?" And so I went, just because at that point, anything was better than what I was doing. I had completely given up, which means that it took me 5 years to get the first step. Once I got to that point, She carried me to an AA clubhouse and left me there. And so for the first probably few months that I came to meetings, I would come and I would cough up my little hairball and I'd cry and I'd snot and I'd be pitiful and I'd be the center of attention, and I thought this was going to work. And then finally, one night, some loving member of the clubhouse took me aside and said, "We really don't give a shit about this." "We've all heard this before. We know what the problem is. And if you'd like to have the solution, sit down and shut up and listen." And of course, I had to leave the clubhouse because I wanted to kill him. Rage was the only emotion that I knew and could identify with. And so I was furious. I was so angry that I not only wanted to be violent towards this perfectly lovely man who was trying to help me, I wanted to burn down the building, slash his tires, the whole thing. So I had to find another meeting to go to. So of course, I found another clubhouse and I went to another series of meetings. Only this time I figured I wouldn't share quite so much. And eventually, some kind lady was very sweet to me and she said, "We have a literature meeting that we'd like for you to come to, and I will meet you there if you will come tomorrow morning at 9:30. And I thought, well, you know, I love to read, that's okay. So I went to this literature meeting and began to listen to the literature in this program. I was amazed at the things that I heard, disbelieving, but pretty apprehensive over the fact that it looked to me and smacked highly of organized religion, which of course was one of my pet peeves. I had gone through many different organized religions, jumping from faith to faith, staying only long enough to understand how it worked, what was wrong with it. I could tell you how to fix it, and I could move on. When I got to AA, and they talked about God, I figured it's going to be the same story. Fortunately, I had a sponsor very early on. Someone in a meeting said, "You need a sponsor, I'll get you one." And she did. And that's how I got my sponsor. And my sponsor convinced me that if I wanted to have what he had, which looked like a pretty nice life, I needed to do the things that he did. So one of those things included praying on a daily basis. I really resented the hell out of that. And I would pray in very mean-spirited, snotty little ways. And it was just really galling that I had to get down on my arthritic knees to do this. And so I would, every night, get down the side of my bed, and I would pray angry little spiteful prayers. And amazingly, none of them were answered. But what did happen was one night, I was so miserable that instead of praying, I just began to choke. I had not been able to cry since my father's death in the 80s. And what happened for me was I thought I was having a heart attack, first of all. The pain was incredible, but I began to cry. And I literally just fell onto the floor beside the bed. And what I did was I cried and cried and cried, and I just said, "God, please help me." I heard myself doing that almost as though it were a dream. And here was my spiritual awakening, as Bill W. likes to talk about spiritual awakenings. I heard myself calling out to God to help me. I must surely believe in something. I don't know what that is. It certainly wasn't the God other people had or could tell me about or tried to show me. But I believed in something outside myself. And that was enough. Just that was enough. I've been in this process and on this journey for a while now, and I still can't give you any better definition for what my higher power is other than something greater than myself. I don't know how it works. I don't know why it bothers. I don't know where it is. But I do know from my personal daily experience that it's there and it works. And that's how the program works for me, one day at a time. The first step was clearly the hardest step for me to get. It took me 5 years. I could admit that my life was unmanageable, and it was usually somebody's fault. But I could not admit that I was powerless, and certainly not powerless over my own body and my use of substances. Once that hurdle was crossed, and I could hear myself calling out to a God I didn't even know, I got to the third step. Third step presented a small problem for me because, being a control freak, I thought that I'd go along with whatever happened as long as I had the ultimate control. I'd call the shots, I'd make the decisions, I would judge everything, let you know where you were falling short. And my big ace in the hole was that, you know, if things didn't go well, you pissed me off, or I didn't like it, I'd kill myself. My sponsor pointed out to me that I could not kill myself if I believed in a higher power, because I could not pretend to be God if I believed that there really was a God somewhere. So we fought about that for a little while, and eventually he convinced me that for 24 hours, I would allow whatever power there is greater than myself to function in my life, and that I would not pull the plug for 24 hours at a time. And I get back to you and decide if we're going to renew this. So that's the way we've done it. We've done it that way for a long enough time that now I know that things that happen to me happen to everybody, that we survive or we don't. And either way, it's okay. The story that I told, you know, the first year of my sobriety is not the story that I've told every year after that. The story I'm telling you tonight is not the story I told last year. When I first came to AA and I heard all these wonderful slogans and cliches and things they had on the wall, we don't have fancy artwork where I go to meetings. We have little, you know, Xerox sheets stuck on the wall that says think and first things first and live and let live. And one of the things I heard was that more will be revealed. And I thought, of course, that meant that you all had some great secret that you were keeping, and that if I stuck around long enough, you'd give it to me in little bitty doses as I could handle it. What I have come to realize is that more has been revealed about me every day that I'm further away from a drink. I had the opportunity to spend time this past 2 weeks sitting in vigil for a woman that I had asked to marry me back on New Year's Eve of 1980. We were a little high. We were at a fabulous party. She looked scrumptious. I was shit-faced. I asked her to marry me, and I was prepared for every possible answer except the one she gave me, which was, ask me again in 6 months. She was holding out for a better offer. Smart girl. She always has been smarter than me. And eventually she got one. We have been the best of friends all these years. I have known her and loved her for almost 25 years now. And she has been dying from ovarian cancer. I have had many people in my life die. They died without me because I was not able to be present. I would tell you I would be there, that you could count on me, and I'd swear to it. I didn't show up. I didn't call. Most times I didn't even make excuses about why I didn't show up and didn't call. Sometimes I would do little geographic changes. The bottom line is that I was never able to be present. I was still hiding. I was still a frightened child who knew that when things got bad, I needed to get scarce, and that I didn't have the ability to cope. Fortunately, things have changed. And so I have sat in vigil with this woman that I love more than anyone for the past 11 days. And yesterday morning, she died in my arms. It was a nightmarish death. People have talked to me about death experiences, and they say, oh, it's so peaceful, it's so quiet, it's so spiritual, it's so... This was none of those things. This woman fought valiantly to live. She struggled. It was painful, it was ugly, it was long. And when she died, she drowned to death in my arms, in her own juices. And her heart continued to beat for almost 3 minutes after she stopped breathing. I stood there beside her bed with my hand holding hers and her head cupped in my palm and listened to her as she gurgled out her last few breaths and watched her chest heave and convulse. And as I stood there, I was able to pray. And I prayed to God to help my friend. That's one of the greatest gifts I've ever gotten in my life. It was a gift of this program that I was able to be present with her, that I was able to be there in a conscious and loving way, and that I was able to feel connected to a higher power to give me the strength to help my friend through a very bad transition. That would never have happened had I not found this program. I am now 55 years old, and I have a future. It comes in 24-hour increments, but so far it's been coming regularly, just like my pension check. I am grateful to say that today, life does not happen to me. Life happens for me. Through this program, I have been able to release my anger. You know, I used to blame everybody for everything, particularly my poor mom. I had stories, when I first came to AA, I had great stories. Boy, I had stories. I could tell you stories where I was either going to be the hero or the victim. And in my best stories, I was the hero and the victim at the same time. And in almost all those stories, my mom was the big villain. If it wasn't my mom, it was some other authority figure or, you know, some poor schmuck I passed on the street. One of the things that I did in my first fourth step was, with all my stories, my sponsor said to me, just write down all these stories. Let's just start with that. Just write down all these little stories you have. And I did. And as I wrote those stories down, it occurred to me that the pattern was the same. I was the hero or the victim or both. I took no responsibility for anything. I blamed other people. I lied. I cheated. I stole. And all of that came from the fact that I was a person who acted out my fear of life in general through anger and rage. I was shocked to discover that I was a very frightened person. Never would have thought myself to be frightened of anything. Would tell you I wasn't afraid of anything. And acted quite rashly and irrationally in a lot of instances because I had no fear of anything. And the truth was, I was terrified of living. I was terrified of being responsible. I was terrified of being present. I was terrified to love or to let others love me because I thought all of those things would be taken away from me or that I would lose them in some way or I would screw things up. All these irrational thoughts that came from the fact that I was an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And through that behavior, I had painted myself into a corner where there was no one to blame, no one to love, no one to reach out to. And in my desolation, that's how my disease kept me going for quite a while. The first step for me in this recovery process was in that fourth step, writing down all those stories and seeing that. And as I saw it, I began to grieve. And I had never grieved over anything. I had never admitted to myself that I could feel sorrow. I didn't really understand what sorrow was. And I had to verify with other alcoholics and with my sponsor what it was I was experiencing, because I didn't know what it was. I just felt really bad. So I had to be taught emotions. I had to be taught how to identify emotions. I had to get help from other people who shared with me their experience, strength, and hope, so that I could understand what I was physically experiencing, what I was experiencing emotionally, and what was happening to me mentally, because I was crazy. No two ways about that. The fifth step came with me learning how to trust one other person, just one. I figured if the worst possible event happened, I had to kill him, I could get away with it. As long as I kept it to just one. So that was my sponsor. And so I started trusting him. Gradually, 24 hours at a time, I began to realize that I could trust whatever it was that I was allowing to work in my life, one day at a time. My sponsor said to me all sorts of wonderful things early on in this program about if I had a great idea, I had to run it by three other drunks and take a vote. Majority rule. I thought that was quite clever at the time. I realized later he was dead serious, and I started doing that, and it really worked. I could not trust my own thinking. So I had to learn how to trust myself, and I did that one day at a time, just by basing what happened to me yesterday on whether or not I want it to happen again today. And if I don't, I have to make a different choice. I can't behave the way I behaved yesterday. One of the most wonderful things that has happened to me, being present with my friend through this process, has been another gift of this program, that I have forgiveness. I was in the household, my friend died at home. I was in the household and dealing with her family of origin and her family of choice, and there was a conflict, as there usually are. Lots of conflicts when people are under stress and duress and frightened. And somehow out of this group of people, I got picked to be the voice of reason, which was great typecasting, I thought. But I'll tell you what happened for me was that I could be the voice of reason. And everything that I had to give came to me through this program. Everything that I had to bring to that situation, I got from people like you in rooms like these, and through the grace of God acting in my life. I want to tell you just a little bit about my use of Alcoholics Anonymous and the way this program works for me on a day-by-day basis. My sponsor is of the school of thought that he teaches me by example. My sponsor will not give me advice no matter how much advice I ask for. He will not give me advice. I finally stopped asking him because I got the same answer all the time and I was tired of getting the same answer, which was pray about it. So I thought I'd get real smart and pray first, and then I'd call him and I would say I did pray about it. And he outsmarted me again, because what has generally happened is if I shut my mouth and set my ass down and pray and meditate, I know what to do. And sometimes all I need to do is just shut my mouth and set my ass down. I have been able in this program to be present in the lives of those people that I have grown to love and care for in a way that is non-judgmental. That's a big one for me. I used to be the kind of guy that could walk into a room, sum your ass up in a heartbeat. I got your number already. I can tell by your eyes, you know, that kind of thing. It's been a big shift for me to just be present and to be one, not the one. It's been a big shift for me to be able to come to meetings and do things like clean windows or sweep floors or set up chairs or make bad coffee, even clean out ashtrays for all you nasty smokers. With love in my heart. I tell you, this program also has given me an opportunity to be present in a way where I can be loving. And I have not been free to love really all my adult life. I wasted 40-something years of my life, almost 45 years of my life, because I was afraid to love. And I couldn't let anyone love me. You could tell me that you love me, and I would know immediately that you were fucking crazy. Excuse me, can you say fucking here? Okay. I knew if you told me you loved me, you were sick, truly sick, and you could not be trusted, and your judgment was very poor. I knew that for a fact. So it has been an incredible gift of sobriety that I can look at people squarely in the eye, and when they say, I love you, I can say thank you. And that I'm able to be with people and say to them, I love you and I care about you, and I can mean it. My son, Dr. Baby, is now 28, twice married, owns his own house in Nashville, teaches at Vanderbilt University. I decided last weekend that maybe I could give up his room. Take the blue bunny off the bed. Possibly use this space for something like a small den or a study. I was one of those people that thought one of my greatest character defects was that I could not let go of anything. Couldn't let go of people. Couldn't let go of anything. What I have discovered about myself is that is probably one of my greatest gifts and blessings, is that I am able to hold in my heart love and affection for all those people, regardless of where they are or what they're doing or whether they're aware of it or not. And I can hold that for as long as I'm here. If that's my mom, I'll call her back. I didn't talk to my mom for about 10 years. I had a great therapist, paid him a ton of money, and he finally thought that I needed to write my mom a Dear John letter. It was the best money I had spent at the time. I wrote my mom this Dear John letter and said, you know, we are toxic together and I just can't deal with your stuff, so please don't call me and don't write me. And so for 10 years, I didn't communicate with my mother. When I got to the ninth step, there were a few things I had to correct. When I was working up my eighth step, I sort of thought maybe I would die before I'd have to finish this list. So I put my mom sort of down on the list a little ways. Yeah, maybe. So eventually my sponsor, who was very sweet and not pressuring me, kept saying things like, have you talked to your mom? Well, no, haven't talked to my mom yet. Don't know exactly what I can say to this woman, the way I've treated her, the things I've done, the things I have done to her. So he started me out a few years ago at Christmas time. He said, I think you ought to send your mom a Christmas card. And I said, I don't know what to say in a Christmas card. It seems to me a little hokey to send my mom a Christmas card when I won't even speak to her. And he said, well, just send her a Christmas card and just sign, thinking of you, Dave. Well, I had to think about that several days because, you know, I'm not real sure how she's going to take that. And I didn't want to make any kind of commitment to anything. So I thought about it for a while, and I found this perfectly wonderful generic Christmas card, and I wrote, "Thinking of you, Merry Christmas, Dave." And I mailed it to her. And she called me. And fortunately, I have an answering machine, and so she left me a message, and I called my sponsor. Guess who called? So he says, "What are you going to do about it?" I said, "Well, I guess now I have to call her back." "Thanks to you." So I called my mom back, and we started communicating. 3 years went by, folks, and finally my sponsor said, "I think you ought to go see your mom. My mom's in Texas." And I said, "I can't go now. It's summertime. There is no geographical difference between Texas and hell in August." So I said, I'll go when it's cooler. Well, fall came, and then Christmas came again, and January followed that, and rolled around till May, and it was already getting warm in Texas. And my sponsor very sweetly said, "Have you made plans yet for your trip?" "Well, not yet, but I'm going to do that." So, summer came, too hot to go, and my sponsor called me up one day, and he said, "Call me back in half an hour." And I said, "Okay." And he says, "When you call me back, have your reservations made so I'll know when you're going to Texas." "Oh, okay." So I called up Delta and found out, you know, that I could probably fly to Texas in October. That seemed safe. And it would be cool, and, you know, I could get hit by a MARTA bus in September. All kinds of things could happen. So I made the reservation, and I called my sponsor, and I said, "I'm going in October." You'd be amazed how fast it got to be October. It got to be 2 days before I was leaving, and I hadn't even thought of what I was going to say to my mother. And so I called my sponsor. And I said, "Do you have any suggestions about what I might say to my mom?" And he says, "Well, you know, she hasn't gotten to talk to you in 10 years. Maybe you just ought to go listen first." So I thought, well, maybe I could do that. So I flew to Texas, rented a car, drove to my mom's home. And just before I left, oh, let me back up. This is great. All this angst, you know, all this angst. The day before I'm supposed to go to Texas, my mom calls me. "Hi, Mom." She says, "You don't really have to come out here to see me." I thought, damn, this is working. I said, "Well, you know, I've already got the ticket. It's not a big deal. I'm already planning to come." She says, "No, you really don't need to come. It's okay." So I thought, okay with me. So I called my sponsor, and my sponsor said, no, not going to work. You have to go. So I called my mom back, and I said, "Well, Mom, I'm gonna come, and I'll be there tomorrow." And then my mom said, "I really don't want you to come." And I said, "Well, you know, I'm coming anyway. And when I get there, I'll knock on the door. And if you want to let me in, that's fine. And if you don't want to let me in, that's fine too. But I'll be there at 11, knocking on the door." And so I did. Flew to Texas, rented a car, drove out to the boondocks, found the house, knocked on the door at 11 sharp, and waited. Dogs barked. I just stood there. And eventually the door opened. And there was my mom. And she said, "You know, it's not because I don't love you. It's because I didn't want you to see me now where I am, the way I live, because I know that you're going to tell me what to do, how to live, what I have to change, what's wrong with me, yada, yada, yada. And I said, well, you know, I might have done that yesterday. You're right. But I promise you, if you let me in, I'll just listen. And so she let me in. And I sat there for an hour and a half and I listened. While I fended off these little bratty dogs that she has. And she talked to me about all kinds of things, most of which didn't make any difference to me, about people I didn't even know. But she talked to me for a while, and as she talked, she was rummaging around in this big grocery bag, big brown grocery bag, full of pharmaceuticals, and was popping pills like they were jelly beans. And I just sat there and listened. And when my hour and a half was up, I left. And I told her that I loved her, and I would see her again soon. I'm going back to Texas this month. I had planned to go a week ago, but my friend's vigil interrupted that plan, and that's okay. You know, part of my process today is the suiting up and showing up. I do that on a regular basis. Whatever happens, happens, and I'm available for that. Whatever God wants me to do, God will let me know. The morning I was planning to go to Texas, actually, was the morning I got the call from my friend that they needed me. And I had said to God, because I knew my friend was very ill, and I had said to God the night before, I said, you know, God, I'm going to get up in the morning at 8, which is pushing it for somebody who's retired. I'm going to get up at 8, and I'm going to wash my favorite jeans, and when they're dry, I'm going to put them on, and I'm going to get in the car, and I'm going to drive to Texas. But if you want me to do something else, let me know, because I'm here. And at 8:30 the next morning, I got the call that my friend was in distress and needed me. And so that was okay. And I called my mom and said to her, Mom, I'm not going to be able to come, expecting her to say all sorts of things. And surprisingly, she said the one thing I did not expect, which was, I understand, darling. You're doing what you need to do. And I'll be here, and I'll see you when you get here. That's what this program has given me. It has given me a life. It has given me a sense of who I am. I have discovered over the past 9+ years that I'm not the person that I thought myself to be. I live today a life that is much greater and grander than any life I have known before. On a daily basis, I discover that I'm a larger person, in more ways than one, a larger person than I have ever been, that I can act and with deliberate care and attention give openly, lovingly, in all good conscience. That's not the person I was before I got here, and for that, I am truly grateful. I'm grateful that you're all here this evening. I hope that each and every one of you have the opportunity soon to stand before a room of your peers and tell them your story. It's a gift. This has been a month of blessings for me. Thank you very much.